Charlie White.
All right, get my notes here. Today is June 30th, 2020. This is a part 14 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Charles Butch Farabee, F-A-R-A-B-E-E. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Butch. How are you today?
Hi, Tom. Good, thanks. And you got my permission to use this. So.
Thank you. So I won't ask you if we have your permission to use this recording.
Okay, no.
Over the telephone, or make this recording over the telephone, so thank you for that. During the last interview, you had talked about how you had to work with the Office of Aviation Services in Washington, D.C. to get a variance for Grand Canyon National Park to use helicopters for short hauls, where you actually hang a person in a basket from a rope suspended under a helicopter. Can you recount some of the short haul uses that you actually did in Grand Canyon that were the reason why you wanted this variance for this rule?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, OAS is in Boise, Office of Aircraft Services.
Thank you.
Actually, a station in Boise, Idaho. Because that at that time, or still is, I guess, is the head of the government's national wildfire program, and it was natural to have them as a, you know, as an aside there, I guess. But you know, I did go to a lot of effort to try to get a variance for using short hauls, which not only would be a stretcher below a helicopter, but also, you know, raising somebody up or lowering somebody, not lowering so much, but swinging somebody in or swinging somebody out without the basket.
So actually putting someone in a hazardous location or in a...
Correct.
Well, I'm thinking about a boat stuck in a rapid.
Well, I'm going to give you one of those examples, actually.
Oh, okay. Great.
So I'm just sort of clarifying what my perspective is on what's called a short haul. And usually the rope might be less than 100 feet below the helicopter.
Okay.
So, and the helicopter in those days was always a single engine, and that was a concern of OAS. If it had been twin engine, you know, a larger ship, then they didn't have the concern, at least initially, because, you know, if one engine quit, you still had the other, which when you look back on it really isn't quite correct either, but that was their reasoning.
And I just, having never been in that situation, when you're 100 feet below a helicopter, are you far enough away from the rotor wash, or are you still getting kind of pushed around by that?
No, you don't get much effect from the rotor wash.
Okay.
You get some effect. If you're moving forward, of course, you get effect from flying through the air, and I always refer to it, or, you know, a hoist in and out of a bigger ship, perhaps, as like the E-ride at Disneyland. you know, pretty scary, pretty impressive, and in the great scheme of things, you know, it's actually dangerous, but it's a pretty calculated risk, and in truth, there's really not much danger, except unless you're on a big wall or something like in Yosemite. I mean, I'm not trying to negate any of the hazard, but it's, you know, it looks good. It's pretty impressive. It's very effective. But so anyway, we're talking about this guy that wanted to commit suicide in the Grand Canyon in a November, and I can't remember the exact year, but it was probably about 1985 or 86.
Okay.
He was at Desert View in November, and his way of committing suicide was to go into the park and die of dehydration and starvation. And I can't think of one of the worst ways to go, you know. So he goes into the park, scrambles down off of Desert View through some low angle rocks and brush and stuff, and he trips and falls, and he hurts himself, and he ends up rolling to about, 15 or 20 feet of the edge, the upper edge of the red wall, which is a 400 or 500 foot limestone cliff in the Grand Canyon. I think it's limestone, isn't it, Tom?
Or yes, sir.
Yeah, I think so. And so at this point, this guy's trying to commit suicide. He starts yelling for help. Somebody hears him. The park responds. And I'm still the management assistant, but I have search and rescue underneath me. And something like that would catch my attention because I always had my radio on, which most of the rangers did much of the time. And a young ranger, very, very talented ranger by the name of J.D. Swed, and I frankly can't remember what the J stands for. It's either John or Jim, I guess. And
how do you spell his last name?
S-W-E-D.
Thank you.
Swed. And J.D. would go on to be one of the Park Service's foremost incident commanders for major events. Not fire, but all the other stuff, earthquakes and hurricanes and inaugurations and presidential visits and stuff. I mean, he was truly very qualified. And so, but at this point, he's still young in the trade, and he's a permanent, but he's a young permanent at Yosemite, permanent ranger.
Okay.
So he's running this operation. We bring in I guess it's an H-46, a Jolly Green Giant out of Luke Air Force Base from Phoenix to help out because it has a winch, and here's a huge helicopter, twin blades, you think it could do the job, but in fact, it could not. It could not hover out of ground effect well enough to do what we need it to do.
Really?
Yeah. So, and I'm no whiz-bang on helicopters and their performances, but we knew that we needed to have that ship up there, but as it turns out, it was basically worthless.
Wow. I had never thought of that.
So, there's a device we began using in Yosemite, and, it's a sort of a nylon partial suit that's a sling that was used in Vietnam.
Okay.
And so we, the Navy, when we were in Yosemite, gave us several of these. And it has snaps and hooks and things and D-rings and things in the right spots that you could hook somebody on.
Oh.
And it's embarrassing that I've forgotten the name of it. It's sort of a silly name, but it adequately describes what this device looks like. And it's very light, only weighs a couple of pounds.
Okay.
But it's this heavy-duty nylon mesh.
Hmm.
So we had one at the Grand Canyon, and I don't recall we ever using it before this, but perhaps we did, but I don't recall that. It wasn't very common, for sure. So it goes down to where this guy is, and he's not hurt, broken backs and that sort of thing, but perhaps something like a broken ankle or something.
Could you tell he was mentally deranged?
Well, I wasn't even on the scene at that point.
Ah.
But, you sort of have to be a little bit off by trying to commit suicide by dying of starvation.
Yeah, but assuming the rangers first on scene wouldn't have known that. They would have seen, some guy's down here and he fell.
Yeah.
And,
that's a good point, and I don't have a good answer for you particularly, but I do know that the ranger that was sort of on the scene, a guy by the name of Joe Quiroz, Q-U-I-R-O-Z, married to the park doctor, Cheryl Pagel. So, you know, and I'm seeing with this guy not too far away from the lip of the cliff, there are about six or seven other rangers. But it's terribly bouldery, rocky, fairly high angle, and to carry a stretcher out of there would have been a real risk to the carryout crew, which is often the case for a lot of these things. You know, a lot of people will tend to be very empathetic to a victim. And, you know, I have some empathy to the victim, but I have more empathy for the rescue team.
Right, right.
And so it's, you know, a decision is made to lift him out with this Jolly Green Giant, which, of course, does not happen. The park brings in the park ship, which is a single-engine Jet Ranger, and Tom Caldwell is the pilot. Now, at this point, I'm actually now out at the scene, although I am not in charge. J.D. is in charge. I'm just sort of a grandfatherly figure sitting in the background. But once we decide, and I say we collectively, I mean, once the decision was made to put this guy into this nylon mesh partial suit, you know, which supports you and your back and your hips and your lower or the upper part of your legs. Once that decision was made, and then to sling him out, I stepped in and took it over. And I came on the radio and said that, you know, JD, I'm taking this this part of this rescue over from you. And I made it very clear that I was in charge. So that, and the intent was not to upstage you or create a problem for JD. Mm-hmm. It was really to prevent him from being sued or having some major liability problems if something went wrong. Because we did not have policy permission to fly this guy out in that manner. And had Tom, for whatever reason, had to jettison this victim at the end of this rope, or had something happened where the guy got caught in a tree or something, and ends up getting seriously hurt or being killed, then JD, who is probably 10 years younger than myself, but at the time had a heck of a lot less rescue experience, had something gone wrong, it would have been more awkward and harder for him to get on a courtroom stand or justify through legal procedures how he came to that decision.
Sure.
But I, on the other hand, had a heck of a lot more experience, particularly with this kind of situation. Not so much the short haul in this, or the name of the suit that we used to call it was a Screamer.
Okay.
S-C-R-E-A-M-E-R, Screamer suit. And that was just shorthand for, you know, some long army term.
Right.
But it would be harder for him, for JD to justify, much easier for me. And if anybody was going to be sued and taken to serious task on this, I wanted it to be me rather than JD. So, and JD and I made our peace not, you know, within minutes of having done this. Afterwards, and he fully understood. I don't think he was necessarily pleased about it, but he understood. And so we put this guy in the Screamer suit, and he's lifted up by the park's helicopter via short haul. And it isn't very far from there to the parking lot outside of the watchtower at Desert View. And he's, you know, raised up, swung. hung over maybe, you know, probably no more than half a horizontal mile, probably less than that, and then lowered pretty gently onto the pavement at the parking lot. And everything's fine. You know, nobody gets hurt, no helicopters crash, nothing very significant. It was an interesting dilemma that the Jolly Green Giant, that we could not use it in that scenario. And of course, they were super in other scenarios, but not in this one. So that was one time we used a short haul. And another that comes to mind, and you mentioned the boats and wrecks on the river. Way down canyon, closer beyond Havasu Canyon, and I don't know what river mile that would be, but way down canyon, there's a raft trip that has gone awry, and at least one of the patrons has been stuck in a little beach, and the beach is probably not much more than, say, 50 feet, you know, wide and maybe 30 or 40 feet deep, and then it's surrounded by these huge cliffs, I mean, 400, 500, 600 feet high cliffs, which are pretty vertical, and they're also crummy rock, and we don't have, I mean, since it's so far down the river, and of course, his boat, the boat that he fell out of or that went over, whatever it might have happened, I don't remember why he ended up. But he's safe and sound. He's not hurt, but he is trapped in this small beach.
So this story, I'm trying to remember the guy's last name, but he was on a one-person trip all by himself, and he flipped. Was it in a Killer Fang Falls at 2:32 or something, and he ended up on the beach. The boat was gone, and he's sort of there on the beach, and he can't go anywhere.
Well, that could be the scenario. I frankly don't remember whether he was by himself,
okay,
or if he was, you know, if there was a little bit larger group. You know, there were enough boat trips along the way that if it were a solo trip, probably somebody would have come by and saw the dilemma fairly quickly. And again, the nuances without looking up for a rescue report or something, I can't tell you. But I can tell you how we resolved it.
Yep.
Which is myself and one other ranger flew down. And we had a rope, because when we went into the scene, we really didn't know what was going on, and we didn't know what the scene looked like in terms of the cliffs and, you know, not being able to get across the river and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we got down there, and I make the decision that if this guy is willing, which sort of, he didn't have much choice.
Hmm.
If he was willing, we are going to make a horse collar out of the rope. And actually, we probably made more like a triple bowline so that he could actually sit in it. But we're going to lift him up and fly him across the river to where we are, which is, some places the river is, 150 feet wide. I mean, some places it's really pretty broad. And it wasn't something you could swim across, and the way the cliffs were designed, you couldn't even jump in the river and float down and get out on the other side.
Right.
And you needed to get on the side that we were on, because the side he was on, he was going to be trapped there forever. So, the other ranger, who I'm not sure who it was, it might have been Larry Van Slyke, V-A-N, two words, V-A-N, S-L-Y-K-E, Larry Van Slyke. Whoever it might have been went over and was able to jump out well enough that he could be, help structure this rope. And I'm sure that we had the rope pre-tied, the knot pre-tied, and Larry would help him get into this temporary sling, which is something that you learn in Rescue 101, how to do.
Okay.
And, we told this guy this is what we're going to do, and he was up for it. And, it is all slick as heck. I mean, he got in it, and he was probably 50 feet below the ship and was brought across, and I got him out of it fast enough, and then the helicopter basically just slid back sideways. I mean, didn't even have to turn around or anything.
Uh-huh.
Slid back across, and whoever was on the other side, let's say it was Larry, got into the same rope and same knot and sling system and got slung back across, and he probably was not more than 25 or 30 feet above the water all the way across. Pretty fast, minimal real danger. If for some real bizarre reason that I can't conjure up, had he had to go under the river, he would have been safe, although he would have had to swim to shore at this point.
Right.
The victim, if he didn't have a life jacket on, I'm sure that we put him into one. But, fortunately, none of that was ever necessary. And I think the whole thing, once we got going, once we made the decision, once we got the rope tied in the right spot underneath the helicopter, and once we got the knot tied and that sort of thing, the whole thing didn't last more than 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's like a lot of stuff that I've been on. I've got a pretty nice photo of... the helicopter with both doors off, slinging this guy across.
Nice.
So anyway, that was another example of a short haul. In this case, the guy's life wasn't in jeopardy, but in order to really actually get to him and rescue him, would have taken a huge amount of work and effort and danger. And the trade-off on this case was, pretty safe, pretty minimal, not very invasive, that sort of thing. So.
And all of this, both these events were happening outside of policy.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. And, there were a couple of other incidents. So one with a stretcher off of the Kaibab, where, because of where the guy was, if I remember right how this worked, I think maybe even Ernie in this case was pretty adamant that this guy had a serious heart problem.
Mm-hmm.
And needed to get to definitive care quick. And, rather than having a bunch of people trooping up and down the Kaibab Trail,
right,
which is not necessarily that easy anyway, this was the way to go. And it was out of the, outside the our policy. But in those cases, I mostly said, screw it. This is what we got to do.
Uh-huh.
The right thing to do, and let's do it.
Once you had the variance in writing, did the use of short hauls then greatly increase?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it was. It wasn't like we were using it as an excuse to start doing more short hauls.
Mm-hmm. Well, whether the need was actually greater, but you were reluctant to use it because you didn't have the...
No, I think that's a good assessment. I think that, all of us, including myself, were a little nervous about getting outside the policy. I was less nervous about it. I've always conducted my life, or not life so much, but professional life, is if this is the right thing to do, then we could probably do it. And if I need to justify it, then that's plan B, and we'll work on it then.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it's a long answer to your question. I don't know that they increased. I do think that, you know, around the whole park system, the use of short hauls became a little more common.
Okay.
But, you know, there are only a certain number of parks that would have that kind of need anyway.
Right.
So it's not like everybody and their brother was being tied below a helicopter and flown all over the park.
Right. Okay.
So that's my take on short hauls there, Tom.
Nice. Well, thank you for covering that, because I think it's a really, again, it's something that today we take for granted.
Yeah, that's right.
I wonder if this would be a good time to talk about the park's relationship with Coconino County Search and Rescue and Sheriff Joe Richards, given that the park had a different management structure, as you mentioned, than Yosemite, where Yosemite was free and clear of any other jurisdiction, but Grand Canyon was not, and had a responsibility or a cooperative, I'm not sure exactly what the language would be, but had a relationship with Coconino County for rescues.
Well, we had a memorandum of agreement or memorandum of understanding, and there's probably a legal difference between the two, but whatever it was, we were obligated to play friendly with the county by written agreement. In law enforcement and in search and rescue and in death, and probably a few other things that I've a little bit forgotten. But from my perspective, that would be the thing that would be the most relevant. Fires might not be so included. I know that we would keep them in the loop, but, you know, the Coconino County and certainly the sheriff's office was not involved with fire management particularly.
Okay.
But the park was, obviously. So, because of the jurisdiction, which is concurrent, which means that, you know, we can enforce certain laws, but the county also has the responsibility to do that. And over time, and when I first got there, there were two resident sheriff's deputies. I couldn't remember the other name the last time, but his name was Steve Luckeson, Luckeson, and then Don Daniels. We're both deputies when I was there. And because of budget cuts and stuff, some, you know, there'd be a couple of years where they might only have one, and there probably were times when there weren't any deputies that were resident just because of the expenses, involved. So, and the park, by and large, had a good relationship with the county, very often at the lower levels. You know, we worked with these men. At the time, I don't recall any women, but we worked with the deputies pretty closely, generally pretty well, you know, pretty good. And they lived either in the park. I think they always lived in the park when I was there, but I think they also could actually work out or live outside the park as well in Tusian.
Okay.
And at the time, Joe Richards, RICHARDS, was the sheriff. It's an elected position. And in Flagstaff and within the county, and I think Tom would probably agree if he remembers Joe very well, was pretty high profile, pretty politically involved. He had to answer to the Coconino County Board of Supervisors.
Right.
They were his boss. So my involvement with Joe, you know, early on wasn't of any great consequence. It was more at the local level. But over time, as I got into the job, and I was there for 6 years, and four of them as the assistant chief ranger and two as the management assistant, and my interaction with Joe became increased over time. But one of the things that would happen, and this was very irritating to not only myself, but to the men and women that worked with me and for me and around me and worked for the park, was that from a search and rescue standpoint, which would involve, you know, a fair number of people falling off the cliffs and dying kinds of stuff, the sheriff would take undue credit for doing certain things. And so the news clipping the next day would be something like this, and I'm obviously paraphrasing, which is Coconino County Sheriff's deputies make body recovery off of, Yavapai Point involving, you know, 500 foot where victim John Doe fell 500 feet and had to be evacuated. And that's the way the clipping would read. And oftentimes, there would be zero mention of the Park Service. And in truth, the Rangers, the park, provided the helicopter, paid for the helicopter, provided the rescue or, recovery rescue team, would make the 500-foot rappel or whatever, do the recovery, get the body back up to the rim.
Wow.
Where the sheriff's deputy, oftentimes just in his cowboy boots, where they, yes, this guy is dead, and, then do whatever paperwork he had to do, and then, ship the body off. And that was a consistent theme throughout the years that
really?
I was there.
Interesting.
And it was very irritating.
Uh-huh.
Very aggravating.
I'm sure.
And, for a while, I would suck it in, and I'm sure that my peers would just suck it up and say, that's just the way it is. So, and as I said, this was quite frequent. There'd be a bad car wreck, and the park would respond and have all the medical attention and provide the ambulance and do whatever. And, oftentimes the park was never even mentioned.
Was this because the sheriff's department had a better connection to the press?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so to sort of finish that thought up a little bit, about 5 years into my time there, which means that I was now the management assistant and worked for Dick Marks, and Dick would be one of the two signatories to the memorandum of agreement or understanding, whichever. As with the sheriff, but I was the guy behind the scenes helping Dick make decisions, and I'd be in the meetings talking about, well, we need to adjust this clause and add this or take this away kinds of thoughts. And of course, we had already worked on these things, as had the sheriff's office, and everybody was trying to do a good job. It wasn't like anybody was trying to hurt the other particularly, but of course I'm biased, but it seemed like the sheriff, of course, was trying to take advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And we were trying to be smart enough that we wouldn't have let them take advantage. So it's like it probably every other not meeting, but agreement kinds of things that you get involved with professionally. But anyway, at one of these agreement things, we had to renew this every couple of years, I think. I told Dick, Superintendent Marks, that I wanted to call these shortcomings or irritating things about the way the press was handling us to the attention of the sheriff. I said, I want to just flat out show him, as opposed to just talking about it. So I went, and I had a lot, probably 15 or 20 news clippings, and you know, related documents and photos and things, and I laid them all out on the table. In those days, the superintendent's office, I guess it still is actually, was in what used to be the visitor center. And there's a meeting room at the bottom of the, you know, first floor and big tables and stuff. And so I laid all this out. And, you know, as we were going through this process of several hours, and Sheriff Joe would be there by with some other people, including one of his main lieutenants, who now is currently the sheriff, Jim Driscoll. And he had, you know, like maybe his undersheriff or whatever the proper term is. So I said, okay, Sheriff, I'd like to have you take a look at this. So I went through these, and I don't know that I went through every particular incident, but I did point out some that were pretty egregious and sort of collectively made the statement that, you know, Sheriff, we did all this work ourselves. We, you know, provided the helicopter, we provided the money, we provided the manpower, we provided the derring do. We did all of that, and yet, in this clipping, this story, you know, the park is not mentioned, and if it is mentioned, it's only a minor two or three words and something like, and ranger's assistant, or some pretty minimal.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, I have no control over what the press does. Well, you know, I wasn't, I guess I like to think that I was fairly politically sensitive, but also did not want to take any kind of real abuse. And Dick Marks was very, very happy to have me do this. He liked the fact that I could represent the park, justifiably so, and keep him out of the middle of it so that he could maintain a more professional, sort of upper management level relationship with the sheriff. And I understood that. I mean, I wasn't trying to, you know, provide a problem for Dick. Mm-hmm. And he knew that, and he trusted me to do this. So I said, you know, Sheriff, with all due respect, you know, you have all the control in the world. You could easily have said that, you know, based on, my information, the Rangers did this, and this, and, you know, like that, and the county assisted, you know, something like that. I said, you could easily do that. So I don't remember what he responded, but I do know that afterwards, because I was still one of my, as a management assistant, I was also, was the public affairs guy, and I would put out the press releases, but I also was in charge of search and rescue and fire. I mean, it was a heck of a combination of responsibilities and sort of divergent from each other. But Dick Marks said, I want you to get, if you can, get these kinds of stories into the press and to the press and beat the sheriff at his own game. And, you know, that became a challenge to me and something I thought, I will enjoy doing this as much as I can.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did. And very quickly, you know, I could actually pinpoint the date. I think there was a plane wreck at Desert View, and six people were killed at night within a mile or two of actually the Desert View complex. And it was, a real messy. Fortunately, no fire. All six people died, at least five. I think it was six people. And you know, I was not running the incident, although I had, you know, I had overall responsibility still for search and rescue. But my effort in this particular incident was to get out there, get the basic information, and I called the Flagstaff paper and the Phoenix Republic right off the bat. Wham Bam to give them this story and, you know, highlight that the park was responding, had done this, and, you know, there are it appears to be all these people are dead because, you know, of course, I didn't say this, but, you know, the injuries were such that there was absolutely no question about them having survived. And, you know, sure, shooting the next day, you know, the story was just fine. It really gave appropriate, it gave us sort of respect that we deserved, gave us the credibility, that's not the right term, gave us, they gave us the correct, what am I trying to say?
Recognition, maybe?
Yeah, recognition. That's
okay.
The right word. They gave us the recognition for having done all this. And, you know, I was, clear as a bell, remember sitting in a little tiny ranger office at Desert View, calling the Phoenix Republic and the Flagstaff paper. What is that? The Daily?
Daily Sun? Yep.
Yeah, Daily Sun. To give them this information.
And I'm surprised, though, up to that point before you became the public relations officer, that nobody had done that, had made those relationships with Associated Press and Flagstaff and Phoenix papers.
Well, I don't know that they didn't make the relationship. It was just that one, you know, my immediate predecessor, Bill Dickinson, who was a terribly nice guy and terribly efficient, great manager, as I mentioned the other day, I think, went to the USS Arizona as superintendent, then back to Lake Mead for a long time as a superintendent.
Uh-huh.
But he did not have the background or the search and rescue or the law enforcement, that kind of a background.
Okay.
And, you know, his agenda was to maybe provide information, but, you know, not in the competitive way that, one, I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And, two, you know, the superintendent had given me some mini marching orders, which didn't take much. I mean, I was ready to do this anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But it was nice to have Dick tell me to do this. And, you know, so, again, I'm not following my predecessors, because before him was a guy by the name of Roger Giddings. And he was very good as well. It's just that they didn't have this perspective that I did.
Right. Right.
So, you know, and as I say, that was a pretty good, pretty fast example of trying to take care of that, you know, that issue. And it went like that. I think the sheriff at that point started to have, I don't know if I had any bearing on any of this, but I do believe that, you know, the papers and the sheriff's department were starting to actually give us more credit for things that we actually did.
Uh-huh.
And so things started leveling off. I've got one other example, if you want.
Please.
And, you know, I'd have to, some of these things I don't even think about until I start rambling like this.
That's good.
But, I don't know, roughly 1986 or so, and you may even remember this, Tom, there was a grandfather and his grandson, and his son was the police chief, I think, in Page, Arizona. And the grandfather and the grandson, who was a boy of about 7 or 8, the grandfather had taken up his little Luscombe, which is the same plane I wrecked, taken up his Luscombe and had flown into the canyon because he had some friends that were on a river trip. They were not too many miles below Elise Ferry. And so they flew in between the walls and they were going to wiggle their wings to say hi, and then, you know, fly out.
And maybe drop some ice cream or something? Was
well, there... not that I remember. I
okay.
mean, that makes the story better. Perhaps that's true. I don't remember that part of it, but I do know that the guy, for all I know, was a very good pilot, but he ended up being trapped between the walls, basically, tried to make a turn, and stalled out. And once you put that little plane on its wing, and you're only even a couple hundred feet up,
mm-hmm.
you do not have a lot of control for a while.
Right.
You want some altitude. And he ends up stalling out and going into the river. And they know exactly where, within, you know, 50 yards anyway, where the plane has gone into. You know, the boat people stay around, and of course they're looking for survivors. They don't know there are two people on board. They obviously know there's one on board.
Ooh.
But nobody surfaces. And, you know, after X amount of time, they realize that, you know, the plane's gone, the pilot and passenger are gone.
Uh-huh.
So they keep on going, but, you know, of course this notice is sent out. So, this takes, to finally find this airplane was weeks. The water is brown.
Oh, wow.
The visibility is about zero. It was below the Puria. And it was close to, I think, Badger Rapids, if that makes sense.
Yep, yep.
And it was upstream of a rapids. So, you know, in the park at this time had a little dive team. There were, I think, six of us that were certified. You know, I had tanks in the SAR cache.
Okay.
People had wetsuits. And it wasn't like there were that many opportunities, but at least twice that I actually dove on drownings in the river. Now, part of the time you do these kinds of things, one, you hope to find somebody, but two, there's also a PR aspect to this, to let the families know that you're trying to do something. You know, you're trying to make an effort, you're trying to really do the right thing, but you also are a realist and understand that, you know, where the visibility is absolutely zero and the water's moving,
right,
the odds are pretty minimal that you're ever going to find anything.
Right.
So we get into a real brouhaha, I mean, something that made the newspapers several different times, because the sheriff, Joe, wanted to capitalize on publicity, and it would certainly be a feather in his cap, so to speak, that the county would find the victims of this. And the fact was, I believe the sheriff was good friends with either the pilot, the grandfather, or at least the son, who was, I think, chief of police in Page. So there was a relationship there as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't fault the sheriff for trying to make this kind of an effort, but at the same time, the park also had this responsibility. But technically, the county also could join in. And on one occasion, you know, the newspaper says, Sheriff Joe Richards is bringing in an FBI team with a side-scanning sonar, and, they will be finding this plane tomorrow morning, something as elementary as that. And it's all, you know, it's in the papers, and it's essentially front page. Well, you know, of course, nothing happens. The side-scanning sonar, I think it's working properly, and the guy that's running it, I think, actually sees the airplane but doesn't recognize it.
Oh, wow.
But But anyway, you know, the sheriff comes out with minor egg on his face because he's made this promise that this plane will be found tomorrow. And, of course, you know, the victims will be located kinds of journalism, right?
Right.
Well, this goes on, you know, for the next numbers of weeks. The sheriff, in this case, Jim Driscoll, who was the lieutenant that I worked with, who was sort of the field lieutenant for that part of the county anyway.
Okay.
And I had a very good relationship, a pretty good friendship, and certainly a professional respect. And early on, I mean, that very first day that we heard about it, Jim got hold of me and asked me if I would put in some divers. And I knew that the river was absolutely zero visibility.
Right.
And, you know, it was right above these rapids. And I said, Jim, no, I'm not putting any of my people in there. I'm certainly not going in, and I'm not going to let my other divers go in. So that's not what Jim wanted to hear. That gets relayed to the sheriff, and I don't know, within a day or two, the sheriff has gotten hold of the Maricopa County dive team, which are basically volunteers.
But out of Phoenix.
Yeah, out of Phoenix, to do this. Well, I mean, technically, the sheriff had that ability or that legal right to do that.
Right.
So these guys get up there. They look at the scene. And they say, and so this goes in the newspaper, right?
Oh, wow.
You know, Sheriff Joe Richards has contacted Maricopa County Sheriff's office divers. And, you know, they will be up here, you know, in the next day or two.
Right. Going to find the plane, going to do the bodies all over
again.
Yeah.
I mean, but, you know, the sheriff makes the mistake of having it in the newspaper.
Right.
Because it's good publicity and it's, you know, he's voted into office. Well, of course, they get out there, and without even contacting the park, you know, and I don't care if they contacted me particularly, but there's no notification of the park that these guys are even coming.
Okay.
I think we read about it in the newspaper like everybody else does. And, you know, they get up there, they get on scene, and they say, absolutely not. We're not going in there. It's, you know, the water is zero visibility. It's above the rapids. We don't know exactly where the plane is. You know, we're not doing this. So now the sheriff's got egg on his face again.
Oops.
So this goes on that sort of way for, you know, a number of weeks. The little boy floats free. He is found downstream a long ways. I mean, 20 or 30 or 40 miles, I think down by Nankoweap. And, you know, several weeks later. I mean, so the boy, bless his little heart, you know, is obviously dead, but he's at least located.
Right. Which is so helpful for the family to have closure.
It is. And that, I mean, yes, and that's certainly very important. And that's one of the reasons we do a lot of things that we do, which, you know, are fairly dangerous, actually, and is to help bring closure to the families and, you know, satisfy some of them.
Yeah.
So we still have, you know, the pilot, who I think is in his 60s, if I remember right. And Alaskan is a very tiny airplane. I mean, it's the one I owned.
Uh-huh.
Actually the same model.
Okay.
And, you know, you have to crawl into it practically. You have to be a sort of a semi-contortionist to get into the front seat.
Okay.
And there are only two seats anyway. And they're side by side. And so the odds are pretty fair that the pilot's still in there. You know, the little boy, much smaller, ends up floating free somehow.
Right.
But so this goes on, the whole thing goes on for several weeks for sure. One other small incident was that the sheriff was friends with a reporter, helicopter reporter from Phoenix, whose name I've forgotten, but who was pretty visible, pretty famous, I think, in local area for reporting and, you know, reporting on various incidents from the air. And he flies up to the park with the, I guess it's a TV station helicopter. And the park talks to him. I don't believe I ever really talked to him, but we tell him that, you know, we don't want him to do certain things because of the air traffic. It's not an emergency. And he ends up getting cited because he lands in a place he's not supposed to land. And, you know, we get into this confrontation with the TV news guys.
Ooh.
And, you know, what are the odds of us winning anything like that? Probably. But we end up citing him, which was, you know, whatever the right exact title is, it's like, you know, illegal landing in a park. So that doesn't help anybody. The sheriff is obviously very irritated about this. He comes to the superintendent and raises Cain. And, you know, this has some slop over on this guy's pilot's license. And, of course, he, you know, is now talking from the air about different things related to us not being very helpful kind of thing.
Right. And I'm assuming, in quotes, that the reporter wanted sort of on-the-scene filming or footage and maybe wanted to see if he could see the plane through the water from the air?
No, not so much that. I think it was more just, personal, one-on-one, on-the-scene kinds of reporting.
I see. Okay.
With I think in this case, maybe when the Maricopa County divers went up there.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And it wasn't like he hung around, you know, for 3 or 4 days, but he was in there for on and off for at least part of a day for sure.
Huh.
So anyway, that goes on and on. And then finally, you know, one day I pretty much wake up and I see that the Puria is no longer running and the water is actually clear. Now, clear in the Colorado River at that point is really sort of a misnomer. You know, the visibility might have been 6 or 8 feet.
Right.
But it was 6 or 8 feet more than we had, you know, a couple of days before. And I also knew that the park had a river trip that was launching from Lee's Ferry imminently, like within the next day or so. There weren't any storms forecast. I kind of knew that the Puria would not flash or run brown again. And, you know, quickly, the Puria is just a side canyon, but it has a lot of silt and sand and dirt in it.
Yeah.
And it colors the water. And that's what, for a lot of the ways, that's what makes the Colorado red, which is what Colorado means anyway.
Uh-huh.
But in this case, that stream was not running. It was not discoloring the water. The visibility was 6 or 8 feet. I knew that there was a river trip about to launch. The park had a river trip, which would take about 10 or 12 days. I asked, in this case, Kim Crumbo, C-R-U-M-B-O, first name is K-I-M, Kim, who was the river runner, had been a SEAL in Vietnam, a Navy SEAL.
River Ranger?
He was a River Ranger.
Okay.
But he's also a boatman.
Okay.
And you know Kim, don't you?
Oh, yes.
Kim. So I said, can we put on some tanks, you know, have some gear taken in? And so we put this gear on board. We will meet you at whatever this spot is, and there's actually a couple of beaches on both sides, fortuitously for us. I said, we will meet you at such and such a time. I get hold of Jim Driscoll and Rex, the sergeant, and Paige. I'm pretty sure that was Rex. I think Rex is his last name. I forgot his first name, perhaps.
Okay.
But I said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go in and see if we can find this plane. You guys want to go? Yes. And, you know, of course, we want them to be there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're the ones who are going to be officially taking care of the bodies, et cetera.
Right.
And, you know, Jim and I are good friends. And I said, but the one thing I would ask of you, Jim, is once we do this, and we fly them in, I mean, and then we fly in ourselves. The park helicopter flies in, lands on this beach. We bring in four divers, and I'm one of the four. We fly in these two sheriff's deputies, the one's a sergeant, one's a lieutenant, just to be there. They're not, they don't have any real active role at that point anyway.
Okay.
We get the boats land, we get our tanks, we get our equipment, and the first two divers, Charlie Peterson and Bev Perry, go in, and I'm with some other diver whose name I forgot right at the moment, and we're sort of back up or going to be another team looking elsewhere kind of a, you know, group. Well, literally within, I'll bet you, 30 seconds of Charlie Peterson and Bev Perry going down, they find the plane.
Wow.
And, of course, we don't, you know, at least in my case, I'm not making any, I'm not telling Jim and Sergeant Rex anything different other than, you know, we're just professional. We know we know what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
When in truth, there was probably some luck involved there, right? But they go down, they find the plane. They can see that the pilot's still in. They actually come up and signal that, you know, they found the plane and the pilot. They go down, they have to break the leg, at least one leg, to get this guy out of the plane. He's been underwater for several weeks, 3 weeks, maybe, perhaps, warm water. I mean, this is not a pretty scene.
Right.
And in the meantime, I think it may be the other diver, you know, we swim across the river to the other side. And they bring the body up, and they get the guy to me. And I don't know how descriptive you would like me to be, but I end up tying a piece of nylon webbing around this guy's chest because I do not want to touch him.
Uh-huh.
Even though I've got rubber dive gloves on, I've got a wetsuit on. You know, skin is sloughing off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is a terrible scene. And we get him up to the beach. You know, I pull him upstream. Pull him up, you know, I don't know, 30 or 40 feet up the stream, side of the stream, a river, to the beach where the sheriff's deputies, we take over. I mean, they take the body over. We help get him into a body bag. And, you know, and then everybody's flown out, and the river trip proceeds, you know, with what it's going to do, and we take out the tanks and stuff. And so everything is sort of cleaned up, if you will.
I'm going to just jump in here for a detail. Yeah. Did the plane get removed as well?
No, I think the plane's still in there.
Okay.
I don't know that 100%, but we did not move the plane the whole time I was there in the next several years.
Okay.
No. And I kind of suspect it's still down there.
Yeah, this was 86. The water has not been very high since then, up, you know, 40,000. So it certainly hasn't been that little spike up to 90-some thousand in 1984. So,
yeah.
83, sorry. So, okay.
Well, it could have, but the thing is, you know, it could have floated off.
Sure, could have tumbled down and
300 feet down
broken up into bits. Yeah, of course. You bet.
Know. But we never took it out while I was there.
Yeah, okay.
So the next day, and, you know, I remind Jim, because, you know, to this point, everything on this part of the incident is being done by us.
Right.
Including, you know, paying the helicopter cost, because the helicopter is not free. I mean,
right.
We have this contract. We pay for it. And even though it's a, you know, 24/7, 365 kind of a contract, we're still paying some money.
Yeah.
And plus, we're flying in the deputies and flying them out and all that kind of stuff. And everything works smooth as heck. I mean, everything is very good. And the next day, you know, I think I probably reminded Jim. I said, you know, I would just please give us credit.
Did you race to the phone as well to call Flagstaff and Phoenix?
No, and I was sort of beyond that point, perhaps, anyway.
Okay.
You know, but in this case, you know, I guess I had my fingers crossed, but at the same time trusted Jim.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day, the headlines on the front page, you know, give us full credit for having found the plane, removed the body, you know, that sort of thing.
Nice.
And so I was very pleased about that. But, you know, we had this ongoing thing with the sheriff about this sort of thing. And I don't know that it ever cleared up. I think it got a little bit better. You know, I think perhaps I'm hoping that, you know, I had some impact on that part of the parks and the county's relationship.
Well, anymore, the park handles its press releases entirely about its in-house search and rescues and
Well, we did too. I mean, it wasn't like we didn't do it.
Okay.
It was just that we weren't fast enough to the phone, or, you know, the sheriff had more oomph than we did.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he got top billing.
Interesting.
I just, you know, I don't have an explanation for it except that, you know, it wasn't like we ignored us doing something. Although I think we tended to downplay a lot of what we did because it became sort of routine for us, which, you know, from an outside perspective, somebody looking in, they might have actually been pretty newsworthy.
Hmm.
But, you know, like maybe we got cavalier and blasé about how we treated these things. But one of the things that happened along the way with the sheriff, which is I'm still talking about, if you still want me to talk about this.
Yeah, sure.
Is that I separated, my wife and I separated in the fall of 1981. The divorce was actually a year later. But, you know, after the fall of 81, we weren't living together anymore. So, and I had two little boys. I was a single parent at home for a lot of reasons, but I had the kids. And during this time, the sheriff came to me, or the sheriff's office came to me, and asked me if I would train their high-altitude rescue team. And I said, well, sure. You know, I enjoy doing that, and I think I'm qualified, and, you know, I would please to do that. Mm-hmm. So I ended up spending a bunch of weekends, or at least a bunch of days, over, you know, a couple of weeks, putting members, and I don't think they were all deputies. Some of them were volunteers.
Okay.
But putting this group of maybe, you know, 8 to 10 people through, you know, quasi-structured rescue, not so much search, but rescue training. And, you know, the Grand Canyon's got these nice little short cliffs, 40 or 50 footers.
Uh-huh.
You know, great place to train, and everything was ideal. We used the park, much of the park's equipment to do some of this. And I was doing this all for the sheriff's office, totally, both free as well as just, you know, good-naturedly. I mean, uh-huh. I enjoyed doing that.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure that I had one or two other rangers, particularly Larry Van Slyke, helping me out because Larry was probably more qualified to do this than I was. So we did that, and that was fine. Now, keep in the back of mind, I'm divorced now, right? So, A year later, perhaps, I can almost come up with their names right now, but the Sedona Fire Department comes to me and asks me if I will teach them, if I will put them through sort of a qualifying vertical rescue school to take a couple of their paramedics, some of their volunteer firemen, as well as a couple, they only had a couple of paid firemen, I believe, at the time, and put them through a rescue school, which took several weekends. I went out on my own time on my weekends, and my kids would go spend the weekends with their mother. And their reason for wanting to do this is because a car is going over the cliffs in Oak Creek Canyon and going into the river.
Yeah.
Kinds of scenarios, which over time turns out to be true. I mean, they ended up having a lot of this over time. So, and I sleep on the couch at the main firehouse. There's no charge to them. I'm sure that, somebody bought me a supper along the way, perhaps. My only request was, I said, if you guys know any nice ladies, maybe you could introduce me. And because I was lonely. And they, that was, for sure. We got Sedona, lots of nice ladies down here. So they do, and I meet a very nice lady and spend time with her over the next several months. And but Sheriff Joe Richards, a couple things. One, he was jealous of the Sedona Fire Department doing any of this. He wanted to keep tabs on, or keep his fingers on this. He wanted his guys, his teams, to do all this. He wanted his department to do this.
Okay.
And I wasn't in the middle of any of that. Whatever the Sedona and the county want to work out, that's their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I think Sedona had some autonomy in that they didn't have to rely on the county for certain things.
Right.
But that was way beyond my pay grade, as well as just not of any real significance to me. So I end up teaching these guys, putting them through a number of weekend classes, and they have fun. That they learned a lot. They ended up having me help them buy equipment, so they ended up making themselves a pretty well equipped and trained operation.
Nice.
Which I have to take pride in it.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So one of the things that happened as an outfall of all of this is that somehow the sheriff learned about my request to just a couple of these guys that, if you know any nice ladies, maybe you could introduce me. And he turns that into, me being Tarzan, swinging out of the trees and grabbing Jane and swinging off. I mean, it was pretty primal.
Wow.
From his perspective, at least the way it was related to me. And it affected our working relationship professionally. So finally, along the way, and this is about, a year and a half or 2 years of my divorce, the sheriff and I, Sheriff Joe Richards and I, clear the air. We meet at the Red Feather Lodge in Tuzian and have lunch. We sit in the back corner for probably an hour and a half or 2 hours, just he and I, one-on-one, nobody else is around, clearing the air. And when I told him about all of this, of course, he was very upset that, one, I'd been teaching these guys, but two, I said, I'll teach anybody. I taught your guys. I was happy to help you and your team.
Uh-huh.
I'm happy to help them. You know, everybody wins as far as I'm concerned. So, okay, so we left that, and then we got into my personal life. And when I described to him the fact that, you know, my wife had run off with another ranger, and you know, I was raising two kids by myself, and I was, frankly, just lonely. Uh-huh. I was interested in trying to meet somebody because I couldn't,
uh-huh,
very easily, at least. As a single father, it just wasn't too easy at the Grand Canyon.
I was going to say, it's difficult at the South Rim.
Yeah, and, you know, you don't want to, you know, you don't want to get involved with anybody that you live close by in a small community like that at the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
So when I explained this, you know, I think the sheriff finally realized that, you know, I wasn't as, whatever the right word is, you know, I wasn't as primitive and there's probably, you know, somebody that could articulate better than I could probably explain this easily, but, you know, I wasn't as bad as it was seeming.
Well, if it sounds like he was trying to very much protect his turf, and you know, he was able to keep ahead of the Park Service while the Park Service did all the work, and that was changing, and he was trying to keep his rescue people being the top dogs in the shop.
I think that's all true, but I also think, though, that, you know, somehow he was taking it out on me personally.
Okay.
Which I didn't fully understand. I mean, one, it wasn't any of his business. But two, you know, I wasn't doing it in such a manner as to be, you know, visible about it. I wasn't out pimping. I mean, nobody was pimping for me. I mean, it wasn't like that. And he, you know, he came across that way initially, that way. And I think at the end, we parted, at the end of my time there, we parted respectfully and, you know, pretty professionally. But it was hard to get to that spot. I mean, there were some rough edges, perhaps on my side, but also on the sheriff's side as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, and this is, I don't know if this is totally politically correct, but the other thing when I was, when he was looking at me, you know, after asking if any of these guys have any lady friends they could introduce me to, he had become sort of born again, and this, I think, colored his perspective on me as a male and as a human being and that sort of thing, and. You know, it took a while to clear all that out, get those, you know, all that backstory cleared up for both of us, probably. So anyway, you know, I don't, you know, when I left, as I say, I think we parted respectfully and professionally. We were fine.
Nice.
We weren't friends, but
but
we were, I think, professional acquaintances anyway. So there you have it.
Thank you. This is always very interesting to learn about the relationship between the Park Service and its neighbors. And in this case, you know, it just sounds like Park did a really good job to take credit for what he was doing. It was really, really wonderful.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm sure that, you know, both before and after my time there, that, you know, these relationships had hard times as well, but you go up and down any organization that deals with people or, you know, rules and policies and stuff.
Right.
You've got ups and downs all the way through.
And funding and training. I mean, if the funding is reduced for search and rescue in the park, I'm sure the park will be relying more on Coconino County Search and Rescue.
Yeah. Well, and the other part of that is that, you know, Coconino, I think, is what, the fifth largest county in the country. I've heard that before.
I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, it's
yeah. I've actually heard second, but but I'm not sure about that. San Bernardino County in California is the largest.
Okay.
But Coconino's way up there. And, you know, they got plenty to do,
right,
law enforcement and managerially and search and rescue,
mm-hmm,
in other parts of the park. And they're happy to let the park take care of its own problems as
right
a rule. But, you know, when we would do that, you know, they would end up taking their credit for it. So.
Yeah, interesting.
I don't know how it exists today. And I'm not so sure I want to know.
Yeah, I'm not. I wouldn't want to say either. So.
Yeah.
Neat. Well, maybe this is a good place to wrap up this part 14. We've been going at it about an hour and 20 minutes. So does that sound like a plan?
Yeah, that's fine with me.
Okay. Well, then with that, this will conclude part 14, Oral History with Butch Farabee. Today is June 30th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin, and Butch, thank you so very much.
Oh, as always, Tom, thank you.